Good morning, and welcome to the Ianthus Q3 2019 earnings conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Instructions for the question and answer session will be provided following the listen-only portion of this call. Before beginning formal remarks, Ianthus would like to remind listeners that today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements that reflect current views with respect to future events. Any such statements are subject to risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results to differ materially from those projected in these forward-looking statements. Ianthus does not undertake to update any forward-looking statements except as required. During today's conference call, Ianthus will refer to certain non-IFRS measures that do not have any standardized meaning prescribed by IFRS, such as pro forma revenue, EBITDA, and adjusted EBITDA, which are defined in the earnings news release Ianthus issued yesterday, November 20th, 2019. Reconciliation to IFRS measures are contained in the news release and our filings. I'd like to remind everyone that today's conference is being recorded on November 21st, 2019. I would now like to turn the conference over to Hadley Ford, CEO of Ianthus. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us on our third quarter earnings call. Before we start, thank you. We greatly appreciate your support and the opportunity to create value for you. We take that trust very seriously. A period of accountability is upon us. Fortunately, in this tough financing market, we are fully financed. We are being prudent with our capital. We are generating cash in our operations, and we need the majority of our Gotham money, not for operations, but for additional major growth in our key markets. Operationally, we are well into right-sizing post our MPX acquisition, fully integrated across all our acquisitions, including two full quarters of MPX. We are right-sizing our company for growth, revenues are strong, and gross margin and EBITDA are moving in the right direction. Customer acquisition and retention initiatives are beginning to have real results, and channel distribution of our brands continues to expand. We are building out our ability to carefully measure and manage our business. We are rolling out our selected ERP system across the company, and we have just completed our 2020 strategic review and planning process that was exceptionally robust and rigorous. And we've established leadership in the governance of your company. We have moved the company to a single class of stock. We recently announced plans to move our board of directors to a majority of independent directors who are wholly unaffiliated with any existing investor or manager. All committees, including audit, nomination, and compensation, will be staffed by fully independent directors. No one told us to do this. It was not required by anyone, but it's the right way to comport yourself when you've been entrusted with capital from public investors. Why do we do what we do? What are we trying to accomplish? In cannabis in the United States, we have a choice. We have licenses to grow, process, and sell cannabis. With those licenses, we may choose to be farmers, retailers, or sellers of branded goods. We've chosen to use your hard-earned money to pursue the last one. Why did we choose this? Let's look at a few numbers. Branded beverage players like Coke, Pepsi, Diageo, Constellation, Brown & Foreman, the list goes on. They trade at 5 to 6 times forward revenues and 17 times forward EBITDA. They have an average 29% EBITDA margin and average revenue growth of 4% across the group. Now let's look at the U.S. MSOs. The United States has been a brand driver for worldwide consumption for three generations, and yet our cannabis peer group trades at 2.5 times forward sales and 10 times forward EBITDA. We all have forecasted margins well into the 30s and strong double-digit growth per quarter. Just look at the earnings that Ianthus and our peers have posted this week. Real revenues, real cash flow, great growth as we all make inroads into the $60 billion existing illegal market. Typically, in an early stage industry like legal cannabis, we would see premium multiples to mature industries for the growth, and yet our group trades at a significant discount to both low growth brand companies and our Canadian cannabis peers. And what about Ianthus? We trade at a further discount to our peers. At the end of Q2, using enterprise to last quarter annualized reported revenue, we traded at 30% of where our peers trade. That just seems crazy, especially when you look at how we are executing. I encourage everyone to look at our numbers not on a standalone basis, but in the context of our peers as we begin to differentiate ourselves on our progress across brand penetration, gross margin, and EBITDA. As we look out over the balance of 2019 and into 2020, we expect to see more store openings, strong revenue growth, prudent expense management, and we'll continue to prioritize our capital and operating investments to maximize returns for you, our shareholders. We are very excited about the remainder of 2019 and the opportunities in 2020 and appreciate your continued support. I'll now turn it over to Julius for more detail on the quarter.
Thanks, Hadley, and good morning, everyone. Our reported revenue for the third quarter was $22.3 million, up 16% from the prior quarter. The Q2 to Q3 increase was driven primarily by new dispensary openings in Florida, continued strength of our retail footprint where same-store growth continued in the mid-teens, and expansion into the CBD market. Revenue for the period was slightly impacted due to softness in Massachusetts wholesale orders as a result of the statewide vape ban. Having said that, based on preliminary results for October and November, it appears that this softness may have been temporary as wholesale sales have picked back up in Massachusetts. On a pro forma basis, revenue for the third quarter was $30.9 million, an increase of 5.9 or 23% from the prior quarter. This pro forma number, which is detailed in Table 2 of our press release, reflects revenue from our pending acquisition of Sierra Well, as well as managed revenue in the states of Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico. I would also like to point out that from a seasonal perspective, this is the slowest quarter for our Colorado operation. Managed revenue includes operations where we have management contracts and or licensed operations, which we are unable to consolidate under IFRS. Moving on to gross profit and margin. Our gross profit for the quarter was $10.7 million, up almost 17% from 9.2 in the prior quarter, resulting in a gross margin of 48.1%, which is up from 47.9% in the second quarter. These figures represent a modest increase from our results achieved in Q2 and are reflective of the scale and operational efficiencies we continue to achieve across the company. The company expects to see continued improvement in gross margins in the coming quarters and years as we scale our operations in our key states, expand our wholesale programs against key markets, and as our lean initiative programs and operational efficiency plans continue to deliver across our footprint. Operating expenses for the quarter totaled $37.3 million, reflecting a modest increase of 5.8% from the prior quarter, which was primarily due to increased salaries from an increase in headcount and increased estimated tax estimates as a result of higher revenue, partially offset by lower share-based compensation and professional fees. To give you more context of that $37.3 million, 14.8, or roughly 40% of the OPEX incurred during the quarter, pertained to non-cash expenses such as depreciation, amortization, and share-based comp. 2.4 was also in non-cash tax provisions. Removing the effects of non-cash and non-recurring items results in a normalized OPEX amount of $19.8 million for the quarter. On the cost side, we saw sequential increases in SG&A and salaries as we continued to add personnel and expand our operations, and we saw a 10% sequential decrease in professional fees as we have continued to focus on cost containment across the organization. During the quarter, we have also recorded $4.6 million of one-time costs, particularly acquisition and integration costs, including advisory, professional, legal consulting, and accounting fees incurred in the quarter. These related to residual MPX integration and license transfers and our CBD for Life and Sierra Well acquisitions. The company continued to maintain expense discipline in the quarter and began to see results of planned expense control initiatives. Our adjusted EBITDA before the impact of biological assets for the quarter was a positive $2.2 million compared to a loss of negative $4.7 million in the prior quarter, representing a 146% improvement. Our adjusted EBITDA net of the impact of biological assets was a loss of $3.6 million in the quarter compared to a loss of $6.9 in the prior quarter, representing a 48% sequential improvement. The details of our adjusted EBITDA are in Table 3 of our press release. Our net loss for the quarter was $15.3 million, which equates to a loss of 9 cents a share. In terms of capital expenditures, we deployed $19.7 million in the third quarter, the majority of which, almost over 80%, was spent on the cultivation and store expansion in Florida, which is reflective of our strategic and judicious approach to our use of capital. As of September 30th, the company had total assets of $831 million, a cash balance of $28 million. The company also has the potential to receive approximately $140 million from the exercise of outstanding warrants and over $70 million from the exercise of options. On September 30th, we announced a $100 million financing plan with Gotham Green Partners. To date, we've received $20 million, and we anticipate closing tranche 2 in December and the final tranche shortly thereafter. The arrangement consists of convertible debt with an interest rate of 13% per year, with interest payable quarterly, and as well as an option to extend the maturity date by 12 months and 50% warrant coverage. Current fully diluted share count is 266.2 million shares, which includes 171.6 million common shares and almost 95 million in dilutive securities. Lastly, I'd like to take a moment to further expand on what Hadley had mentioned around corporate governance. On October 17th, we announced our nomination of 5 new independent directors in an effort to move toward having an independent board of directors. Subject to the shareholder vote, which is being held on December 5th, the Ianthus Board of Directors will be comprised of 3 members of management and 5 independent directors. The 5 nominees bring a wealth of experience and proven track records from across multiple industries, including finance, marketing, and retail. Institutional Shareholder Services and Glass Lewis, 2 leading independent third-party proxy advisory firms who provide voting recommendations to pension funds, investment managers, mutual funds, have both recommended that shareholders vote for all proposed resolutions at the upcoming annual general and special meeting of shareholders. With this, we have completed one of our main 2019 objectives, transforming our board into a best-in-class board within the cannabis space, which is truly independent and highly experienced. I would like to now hand over to our COO, Pat Tiernan, for an update on our operations.
Thanks, Julius. Good morning, everybody. I got to tell you, I'm so excited about the path we're on, in particular because we're just getting started. It's interesting to me what I see reported in the industry. A new dispensary here, more cultivation there. These are interesting, but let me tell you about what I see within the business. Of course, my focus is on the customer, profitability, cash flow, return on capital, and an ongoing focus on operating performance. But the fun I'm having is about developing and leveraging brands, acquiring and retaining customers, expanding our points of distribution, cranking up the innovation engines, and enabling initiatives that allow us to improve across the board. At my last company, Stone Brewing Company, a leader that punched well over its weight in brand and had one of the largest craft beer distribution companies in the world, became very successful because of the focus on these dimensions, and is where our focus needs to be as well. I see us moving to best-in-class dispensaries, generating margin in all that we do, cracking into the top 5 in the categories we play in, and driving double-digit market share gains, in a sense, blowing out distribution. The talent we have on the team, Todd Koenig, Wally Woolston, Julie Winter, John Henderson, these folks leading the businesses, they've done it before in companies both small and large and done it successfully. There's so many I just don't have time to name. With our expanded leadership team, we've just finished our initial round of our 2020 business plans in New York over the last couple of days. The energy in the room was palpable. Mike Medore leading the thrust in Florida, Drew Reich in Maryland, others I can't name and don't have time, but it was awesome to see. Indeed, it's a very exciting time to be in the business. I'm not only motivated by the results we've generated thus far, but the potential we have moving forward. So let me give you some highlights of the quarter. First on revenue. Eastern region revenues increased to $13.2 million, up 30% from the prior quarter, as a result of the company's expanded retail presence in Florida, where we added 4 more stores, as well as increased demand for MPX-branded products in Maryland and our continued expansion of our CBD business, which was up 37% over the prior quarter. As Julius noted, we saw some offset by lower wholesale revenues in Massachusetts due to the ongoing vaping products ban, but order indicators are showing recovery, and the alternative products we've released have helped offset that gap while providing some upside moving forward. Western region revenues increased to $9.1 million, up 1% from the prior quarter due to very strong same-store sales at retail in Arizona, but also countered by lower wholesale in Nevada. In Nevada, we had a planned shift away from bulk wholesale offerings to selling more MPX-branded products, so we expected some softening as it just takes a little time to drive increased distribution of branded goods. Our retail revenues totaled $14.4 million and were up 28%. On a same-store basis, sales were up over 17% over the second quarter. Next, on to brands. Our initiatives to build the MPX brand, further the leverage of the acquisition, and listening to the consumer through new customer insight initiatives led to a successful extension of the offerings of new products across Arizona and Nevada. It included edibles, cultivar pre-rolls, a new brand of black label concentrates. Feedback has been strong so far, and we have plans to release these products across the entire footprint starting in the fourth quarter. Our innovation is absolutely key and is paying off. The efforts to heighten demand and preference are also paying off in the existing lines as well. In Arizona, MPX is now ranked number one in non-vape concentrates category and commands a 12% market share as reported by BDS. In Nevada, we've just broken into the top four in the same category with a 5% share and have a fifth of the top 20 products in the market. Preference is building for our core, and this is just great to see. In Maryland, for example, our MPX products are now in 77% of the dispensaries statewide. And speaking of distribution, we continue to build momentum in all of our markets. Overall, the company's THC products were wholesaled in 186 dispensaries in the quarter, up 12% from 166 in the prior quarter, with an average penetration rate of 54% in the states where we wholesale. In CBD for Life, we're now in 2,300 doors across the country, up 53% from the second quarter. And we've signed three new aggressive distribution agreements, gaining access to over 43,000 outlets, and built a fantastic team to drive results and satisfy our chain distribution and customers in general. Across every state, we're up double digits and gaining traction by having the right product assortment, wide and timely availability on the shelf, and an experience our customers and partners find reliably easy and trusted time and time again. Next, like distribution and brands, we're centered on customer acquisition, their experience and retention, and of course, around the right product assortment. I mentioned same-store sales, certainly a good indicator. We hit plan to open four new stores in Florida, bringing the total in the state to nine. We have another scheduled for later this month and a couple more next month. There's four more under construction currently and have seven more leases signed and ready for build out next year. And our revised larger store in Scottsdale, Arizona, in fact, opens on Saturday. So we're really excited about that. These new stores are great, but what I'm thrilled about is the newly employed customer acquisition and retention loyalty initiatives that we've launched throughout the company. We saw an increase of 30% in unique patients, an improvement of 8% in retention, and all of this leading to an improvement of average daily transactions of over 28% in our retail channel. Florida, for example, our net promoter score of 61 is just great to see from the push in the state. But of particular strategic importance on the CBD side, we completed our e-commerce and 3PL transition. I'm pleased we hit this out of the park. It not only makes conducting business with us significantly easier for our channel partners, but it also enables several planned improvements in servicing our B2C channel. In fact, since its deployment, we've seen a doubling of our conversion rate across our web properties. So initial results are really encouraging. Finally, I'll give you a snapshot of some key initiatives and capacity. Overall, our total production increased 11% in the quarter to 5,900 pounds from 5,300 in the second quarter, despite having less access to our outdoor shade facility in Florida over the summer months, as expected. In addition, we opened up Building 5 on the Florida campus, resulting in the doubling of our indoor flower capacity and a 4x improvement of output to be realized in the fourth quarter. Our flower is regularly noted as or among the best there, so having expanded capacity up and running in the fourth quarter is key. In Maryland, to meet robust customer demand for our MPX products, we invested in a new state-of-the-art lab and equipment to increase our processing capabilities to over 8,800 pounds by the end of this year, on track. Our lean initiatives deployed in Massachusetts, Nevada, and Arizona increased yields, lowered cost per gram, and resulted in about a 4-point margin improvement in those states. So good early signs of those programs working. The process work we've done to deploy formal sales and operations planning, new product introduction, and procurement consolidations are gaining good traction. These initiatives will ultimately help us not only execute for our customers with the right products in the right places at the right times, but help ensure the highest fill rates that maintain a very positive experience across all the shelves we sit on. Our first adult use store in Massachusetts was approved in Worcester. Sorry if I didn't say that right for everybody out there, and is under construction with a targeted open date in early 2020. Construction continues at our flagship Brooklyn B store with a targeted opening date in late January 2020. Perhaps most strategically, however, we finalized the plan ERP selection we've been working on in preparation for program deployment in the fourth quarter. We'll deploy a multi-phase, multi-year program to improve operational transparency and predictability, cost reduction, and business performance. Data enablement across the entire operation is simply paramount in order to have the real-time visibility and controls necessary not only just to steer the ship, but continue to right-size and streamline the operations. I'm very excited about our path forward. The team, talent, systems, and processes we put in place, we've only just begun. This business isn't just about the number of states, the number of licenses. It's about growing strategically and profitably with a plan, a team, and the capital in place to be a leader for the years to come. Thanks. Now I'll turn it back over to Hadley.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks, Julius. We're now ready to answer questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw, please press the pound key. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And your first question comes from the line of Robert Fagan from GMP Securities. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys, and thanks for taking my question.
Hey, Robert.
Hey, I thought I would just ask about Julius, maybe about or Hadley about general capital deployment decision criteria now, and you know, with seemingly a good amount of liquidity available from the Gotham Green structure. How would you rank your kind of most important capital deployment projects where you see the best return? Like, are you maybe going to focus on certain areas of the platform for, you know, initial deployment over others? I'm just trying to get an idea of these strategic priorities.
Sure. I think that obviously we look at some of the dynamics that's happening in some of the key states in terms of the supply and the demand and the robustness of the program. Obviously, you're quite familiar with what's been happening in Massachusetts and Florida, whether for ourselves or anyone else. Those are obviously top priorities, and I think we continue to distinguish ourselves there. We're building great market share, and we're going to continue to make sure that we're deploying adequately in both of those states. And then I think as we start looking up further ahead, in terms of ballot initiatives, for instance, in Arizona, that is something that we already have one of the leading market shares within that state. We're going to continue to make sure that we're preparing for potential adult use in that state. That's obviously a big target. And then I would say, lastly, New York and New Jersey, which just in terms of population with over 30 million people and adult use and recreational on the horizon, those continue to be a focus, but we continue to be prudent in terms of the spend in those states as based on better visibility and transparency into the timing of those programs, as well as ballot initiatives or legislative initiatives. But that's generally how we would rank everything. And then sort of the final one, obviously we have a great position right now on the wholesale and cultivation side. In Nevada, you are obviously familiar with the Sierra Well acquisition. There's going to be some integration efforts in terms of building out that platform there, which again is going to give us sort of a similar presence and potential market share that we have in some of the other key states.
Okay, great. That's a great overview, Julius. Thank you. If I could ask another one on focus on Florida for a moment. So, you know, we did kind of see a little bit of a drop-off on the flower side, just on the volume basis in the past, let's say, month or so. Is that just a function of, you know, rooms being cleaned out and that's going to rebound quickly, or is there just anything that short-term could derail or could not allow your volumes to rebound in Florida?
This is Pat. The answer is no, nothing unexpected. Two real drivers. One, the opening of our Building 5 indoor grow. It's about a 27,000-foot incremental addition for flower capacity. And the closure of our shade structure. It's only really produces a couple cycles a year. Things don't our plants don't tend to like that climate down there in the summer. And so, indeed, we did anticipate the softening. However, it was a process of getting the new infrastructure launched during that period. And so we actually only see an increase moving forward.
Okay. Well, thanks for that detail, Pat. As a quick follow-on in Florida, are you guys just wondering if there's any kind of pricing pressure that you guys are noticing at this time? I mean, you know, the market is obviously growing really well, but I was just curious if, you know, there was maybe a little bit of pricing actions happening, you know, to get promotional on either extract or smokable flower product.
No, we have not. In fact, we've made a number of pricing adjustments ourselves to better serve our customers in different categories and products, and we've seen an actual slight increase.
Okay. Okay, great. I guess if I could try and find out about Sierra Well time frame from you guys, if you could maybe just provide an update on when you think you can close that transaction. And, you know, kind of a similar question is we can see in the pro forma revenue numbers some very, you know, robust sales. Is there some competitive advantages that Sierra Well has that gets them that kind of strong revenue generation?
Sure. This is Hadley. Working backwards from your questions, they have a great reputation from a retail perspective, that number one share in the towns that they're in, and it just comes down to customer service. When people come in, they enjoy being there. There's a broad selection of products, and they've had leadership from day one. Very excited to be working with the team there. We're doing what we can from an integration perspective until we close the transaction. From a closing perspective, you know, it's cannabis, so there's politics. It's the way the world works. Hard to give an exact date on what we see, but we have complete confidence the transaction will close sometime probably in the first half of 2020.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys. Okay, I'll go back to the queue.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Brett Hudley from Seaport Global. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hadley, I just have one question for you on funding, and then maybe I can ask a question to Pat on the wholesale business. So I think going alongside the comments on the funding announcement, something else that I talked to investors a lot about recently is the confidence in actually obtaining that financing. So if we could get a comment from you, Hadley, as it relates to the full $100 million from GGP, you know, as capital gets tighter across the marketplace broadly, and as you continue to just have regulatory risk over the space, it feels like cannabis capital suppliers are going to start maybe having to make some tough decisions. And I know with GGP, they have multiple uncommitted lines of convertible credit, you know, outstanding out there. And so I think people are wondering if GGP and other capital suppliers are going to have to, you know, if they're going to actually follow through on making all these funds available. So to the extent that you could just give a comment on your confidence with your particular funding, I think it would help.
Oh, sure. And I guess, firstly, I don't lose any sleep about the availability of money from Gotham. It's the reason we picked them as our partner a year and a half ago, been tremendously supportive, and have always followed through on everything they've always said they're going to do. You know, I can't speak to their structure and internal dynamic, but, you know, I do know them personally. They never say something unless they can deliver it. You know, I have full confidence that
If we do need the capital, that it'll be there. And I would like to make an observation that we are cash generative in our operations. We're covering expenses, we're covering maintenance CapEx. The vast bulk of that money from Gotham is for growth initiatives. So the viability of our company is fine. It's really the growth aspects of it. And we like to be in that position. We think that can help differentiate ourselves against a lot of our peers in the marketplace in 2020.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then just, Pat, my second question is on the wholesale dynamic in Nevada. So that state has just been noisy over the past year. And, you know, I'm wondering if some of that noise is leading to certain competitive actions within the state, up and down the supply chain. So when you talk about the mix shift that you've made, are there any other factors that we should be aware of as it relates to your wholesale business getting back on track outside of just pure channel fill? Thank you.
Sure. So I think the West is an interesting market. Whether it's California, Nevada, or Arizona, I think they're all leading indicators for what's to come at some point. I do believe that the competition levels have increased, but if you look at BDS data, they actually outweigh on a average retail price per gram over both Arizona and California fairly significantly. I believe that's probably due to the transient nature of the state and its visitorship. But I don't see any immediate challenges in wholesale distribution. For us, this was about a former business model that relied on selling wholesale in bulk. And there's just more value to be had on the branded products goods side. But that takes the right sales team, the right pricing structure. You have to have boots on the ground and trucks to get the product there, and we're just doing a better job of doing that in general in that shift to branded products. We've also launched a new business model in both states for toll processing to use our capacity, because our partners find that we can execute consistently and with higher quality and we can differentiate ourselves against our competition in that regard. So we believe that that's an upside for us as well, outside of the wholesale of the conventional wholesale business as well.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Matt Bottomley from Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking the questions. Just wanted to touch briefly on the adjusted EBITDA. So given your pro forma bridge is sort of 50-50 split between, it looks like Sierra and then your managed revenues, you mentioned Sierra is already operating at about a 20% margin, positive net income. I'm not quite sure how the cost structure works for the managed revenues below that line. So can you give any color on what your pro forma adjusted EBITDA might look like today? Because it seems like it could be positive already. I'm just wondering if you can give any color on that.
Sure. So, hey, Matt, it's Julius. So, yeah, some components of it, and obviously with what's happening in Colorado, that will be a state that we will be able to sort of consolidate, and then that will move into our reported revenue next year. So just wanted to call that one out. And then obviously, as Hadley mentioned, Sierra Well, where that will move in as it closes, that will move into our IFRS revenue. So if we were to bundle both of those together on a pro forma basis, we would still have a slight loss based on Q3. But just given directionally the way that the business is moving, with both of those sort of being bundled in or incorporated into our structure, we would be very close on a pro forma basis. For this quarter. And then I think as we look out sort of a quarter or two with some of the built-in growth that we're already seeing, and obviously we're halfway through Q4, and some of the cost containment initiatives, we have a lot of confidence in that direction. And I think that you're going to see a continued strengthening on that line over the next couple quarters.
Great, thanks. The next question relates to your Western operations. And I believe, just looking back, we obviously MPX had some Eastern contribution in their historical numbers, and I think they reported in Canadian dollars, if I'm correct. So I'm just trying to line up where MPX was you know, a year or so ago, particularly in Arizona, and how that's trended today, given that we do see a relatively flat contribution from that part of your segment reporting, but obviously it's the Nevada portion wholesale that's bringing it down. So can you carve out just how Arizona in isolation is doing, you know, over the last year or so since acquiring and integrating MPX?
Sure. So this is Julius again. I can give some sort of historical context around sort of the Arizona business. First off, I would want to call out that the way that MPX had consolidated their operations in Arizona, there, in my mind, there were two components of it. There was, first off, the Arizona IFRS business that's all fully consolidated in our numbers right now. And then there was a part of the MPX Arizona business that we have taken a more conservative approach, and we have that in managed revenue. So there's a component of there's obviously in our reported revenue, and then there's some in managed revenue. That all used to be in MPX's numbers. So first off, and Matt, I can walk you through some of the nuances offline around that, or walk you through some of the financial statements. So that's the first component. But when I also look at where they were a year ago compared to right now, we see that business sort of on the retail side, it's continued to have strength across all four dispensaries. On the retail side, it's probably up over the year around 10 to 15%. And on the wholesale side, which is really only, was initially only a couple percentage of the total revenue, that's grown to be about sort of 5% of the pie right now.
Yeah, I can add color to that, Julie.
Yeah,
if you're interested. Yeah, so from the retail number, these are not official, official numbers. Last year we did in Arizona at retail, right around $21 million. This year we're up, as Julius had said, and that's with the shutdown of one of the major dispensaries, because we are redoing the dispensary for the opening that I mentioned earlier in the Scottsdale location. We've taken revenues on average in the high fours, 400,000 per month, and we're now punching over 600,000, so pretty good growth rate and the focus and the customer engagement programs there in the state.
Great. And Matt, I'll just add one other quick point around that. In sort of the revenue that is in the managed revenue for Arizona, that is a it is a manufacturer of vape carts and vape pens across Arizona. Given some of the volatility in that business, there has been that has moved some numbers around. That is a lower margin business compared to the typical Ianthus businesses. As I mentioned, that's not part of our reported revenue or our IFRS revenue.
Understood. And just lastly, you had mentioned early on a previous question, or perhaps in prepared remarks, that New Jersey and New York, you're going to be more prudent in your CapEx allocation, given that those programs are still medical and there's still you know, some news flow to come. Just curious what we can expect specifically in Q4 and maybe early 2020 with respect to what you plan on your spend in those two states, if not in dollars, maybe just the types of CapEx by category that we can expect as you continue to move out in those markets.
Sure. Oh, go ahead, Julius.
Yeah, sure. And Matt, I think our number one perspective with those states are that they are incredibly valuable and that there are huge end markets. What we're always trying to work with is the visibility of when those programs come online. We've obviously seen a state like Massachusetts where it's been very, very difficult to plan how various states or recreational or adult use comes online. So first off, we're always attuned to that. The second thing I also want to make the point of is that we understand that we have a license from the state, and there are sort of regulatory requirements that we have within those states that we have to comply with. So in the state of New Jersey, we will have plants in the ground in December. That is regulated by the state, and we are always going to make sure that we're observing the necessities of those regulations. So we're continuing to move forward in New Jersey, but until we get sort of continued visibility into the expansion of some of those programs, where you're not going to see sort of heavy CapEx spends over the next couple quarters, but you will see us continue to move the ball forward there. Pat, I'm not sure if you
can add on. No, I mean, that's we're on track to both open up our dispensary as well as the grow that's required by law per what Julius just said. So I think, you know, low couple of millions for the near term and increasing as the reality of the market takes shape.
Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Matthew Pallotta from Echelon Wealth Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my question. Just wanted to touch on Massachusetts. You said there was a bit of a decline in wholesale revenues due to the vape ban. Just wondering how transitory that is. Have you seen wholesale pick up again after the quarter with different sorts of products demanded and sort of a substitution for those vape sales where the demand was previously? And if not, when do you expect to see that pick up again?
So this is Pat. We have, as Julius noted, and I noted earlier, an uptick in the wholesale channel in the October timeframe and the early part of November thus far. We've also introduced a couple of new products like syringes that we didn't offer before that are showing some pretty good uptake as well. So it's not completely replacing that revenue as of yet, but if orders continue at their current pace for the rest of the year, I believe we'll still show a slight decline but have recovered. I think what we hear from our partners is people are preparing for that ban to go away. Now, we don't know whether it will or whether it won't, but the actions being taken by our partners that we typically supply are putting in orders and are communicating with us that they want to be ready for when that ban lifts.
Okay, and are you guys at all supply constrained in that state? I mean, I know there's been talk of other operators who just don't have enough supply to meet the demand on the wholesale side. It sounds like you guys might have more than enough to meet your demand. Just wondering on that front, and if there's more supply coming online that state in the near future.
So we sell everything we make. Our flower, Mayflower flower, is noted as the best. The feedback from our consumers there is nothing short of fantastic. I personally wish I had more flower capacity today, but really our channels and the limits that we have currently on the dispensaries with regulatory approvals in other markets are more the inhibitor for us than supply. Our Fall River facility, which essentially doubles our current capacity, depending on when the authorities say we can open it, probably thinking about that right now in the May timeframe on the medical side, would essentially double that capacity from our Fall River cultivation and add significant kitchen facilities as well. It also allows us to execute a few what I'd call scale-out initiatives and leverage between the two sites that will obviously improve our COG profile as well. So we're looking forward to that, but I would say the answer to your question is we're not constrained at the moment. I just wish I had a little bit more flower capacity to satisfy the two channels that we're operating in.
Okay, and then quickly back on Nevada, I understand the mix shifting from sales of bulk, I'm assuming that means bulk dried flower, to MPX branded products. Just wondering as well if you are at all supply constrained in that state, given that you're shifting, you know, raw product into another line there, and if there's any plans to increase capacity beyond what you already have there.
The answer is yes and yes. It's currently being discussed actively in the company with certain initiatives that we're putting into the budgeting process. As I just noted, I wish I had more. The other dynamic in the Southwest for us is that the players that do have capacity, we find it challenging with the quality levels and the consistency that they can provide. And, for example, we were the first to launch live resin products on the vape side, sauce carts, if you will. And to do that requires a certain level of quality in your biomass. And so our focus there is to be very selective in what we can purchase on the wholesale side as well. But yes, we are constrained in Nevada, and we are actively looking for expanded cultivation.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Jesse Pitlack from Cormark. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I just want to kind of come back to the Massachusetts wholesale dynamic. Just kind of given that the ban actually came in, you know, at the very end of the quarter, did you experience more of a gradual softening just through September as kind of these vape headlines kind of made their way out and the ban kind of accelerated that? Or what was kind of just the dynamic to kind of drive such a big softening in that market in the period?
Hey, Jesse, it's Julius. There were some planned wholesale orders, specifically on the trim side, that were scheduled to, in the back half of September. And it, as you correctly pointed out, the ban, I think it was around September 15th or 16th that it was actually announced. There were some scheduled trim orders toward, once again, in those last 2 weeks of the month, which were canceled at that point. But then we saw whether those customers or other customers sort of come back in, whether around trim or whether around trying to shift to other products on the wholesale side. So it was somewhat temporary, but I would call it a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction in those final 2 weeks of September. And what we've also seen, one other just general point, is just around the vape ban, we've continued to see strength on the retail side within Mass. We've seen substitution away from vape products into flower, some of the other products there. So it hasn't been necessarily something that's a hit at the retail level, overall revenues all that much, but more so on the wholesale side. But again, a little bit more of a knee-jerk reaction.
Got it. That's helpful. And then maybe just switching gears to CBD for Life. I think in the prepared comments, you mentioned that products are now in 2,300 doors, and you've also signed three deals for expansion to 43,000 outlets. Did I hear that correctly? And if so, can you maybe just give a bit more color on some of those deals?
You did hear that correctly. Julian and her team, which has been put together over the course of the last 4 months or so, has done a phenomenal job in developing relationships within chain accounts, whether it's Dillard's or a number of others that we're currently in, has just done a fantastic job developing the chain side of that business. In addition, we've brought on increased marketing efforts and other channels that we've really focused on quite extensively for general distribution across the United States. So three partners have been brought on. And these partners have access to over 43,000 outlets across the nation. And that business is essentially just ramping up. So we're really excited about it. And then even more so, if you think about this type of business, we had limitations in fulfilling orders, not because of supply, not because of any manufacturing, but simply logistics. And so the shift over both in the e-commerce side to just make it easy, connectable for any chain account. They oftentimes have their own purchasing requirements and how to conduct business electronically has greatly smoothed sort of the ability for these customers to transact with us. And new 3PL partnerships have allowed us to really streamline delivery across the nation. Julie and her team, Julie Redfern as well, on the marketing side is just doing phenomenal jobs, and the training teams that they're doing with the accounts for the benefits of CBD has just been outstanding. So we're really bullish on the business, and it's really allowed us to get that our footprint extended across the nation.
All right. Thank you. That's all for me.
Your next question comes from the line of Alan Brockstein from New Cannabis Ventures. Please go ahead. Alan, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't ready for that. Sorry about that, guys. Just a couple quick questions. It seems like you're making progress in the CBD business, but unless I missed it, it's not being detailed. And I'm just wondering if you guys will provide or can provide just some sort of color of the magnitude of that business and profitability.
Alan, your voice went out just to, I couldn't hear about which business.
The CBD business. Sorry, Julius.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Yeah, so that's not something that we specifically segment. We don't segment at this point. Going forward next year, depending on some of the different dynamics, that may be something that we will provide a little bit more segment detail around, especially as that business continues to grow. So some of those expanded doors and the expanded pipeline, that's all happening in real time right now. As we start to get better visibility into what some of those channels look like, that's going to be something that we evaluate how we present or segment out next year. I think that's one component of it. I think generally the second part of it is, though, in terms of what the actual dynamics of that industry look like. It's obviously a CapEx-light business compared to some of the typical licensed operations that we have, so that it has a different profile. Obviously, there's different inventory requirements and working capital requirements, but generally from a gross margin perspective and from a margin perspective, it is something that is definitely additive to our business, and it's something that as that business continues to grow, I think it's going to add continued strength to our gross margins across the entire company.
Okay, and then I have a very detailed, specific question. Colorado doesn't seem core to you guys. Public companies can now, you have the ability to consolidate it now, but you also have a bigger market to sell your single asset into. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on Colorado. Go bigger or get out of it, or just stay where you are?
Alan, it's a great question, sadly. I think you note correctly it's not core. You'd have to make a decision to go deeper in the state or get out. It's something we have on the table as part of our 2020 strategic planning. We'll have more visibility on that going forward through the balance of the year. But it's on the table. It's up for discussion, as sort of all new markets or existing markets are when we do our planning process.
Got it. And then bigger picture, if I understand correctly, you think the store is the most important thing. And obviously, you're doing a lot of things right now, creating your own brands, but more importantly, building out all this capacity that ultimately you may not want to have, and it costs a lot of money. Now, I'm just wondering, as you think about, you know, the tough environment that we're in right now, that hopefully changes, but it's probably not going to instantly change, you know, some of the capital projects, are you prepared to cut some of them back? I mean, you've already shared some of your priorities, but, you know, are you guys thinking, as you talk about this 2020 planning, are you prepared to cut back?
Yeah, that's a great observation. I think, Alan, you and I have spoken about this in the past on, you know, today, just given the federal legality and the state legality, you're forced to have this strange way of creating products where you have to be vertically integrated state by state by state. I think we all recognize that at some point in the future, you know, pick your favorite crystal ball, you'll have federal legality and you'll see a centralization of grow, processing. You know, it'll look, start to look like a normalized industry at that point, which by definition means a lot of the capital you're putting to work in a lot of these states has no terminal value. So you have to be exceptionally judicious when you're making those decisions. And that's why you'll see us do things, as Julius referenced earlier, incrementally look at things. You don't want to build out a million square feet in New Jersey if you don't really have great visibility on the demand curve and some view as to what's going to happen over the next few years. So you'll see us adding incremental, trying to, you know, do that feathering of where the demand curve is, what the politics are, and what we need to actually have enough supply to meet our demand. It's quite challenging, both from a strategic perspective and a corporate finance perspective, and that's key to our process that we're going right now. You've got a certain amount of capital. You have a lot of projects across a lot of markets, and you invest to get the best bang for buck for your shareholders' money. And you kind of start at the top and say, wow, these are really great slam dunk projects, and you finance those and you work through them, and you know, then you get down to a certain level and you say, okay, that's it. We'll wait and see what happens.
Okay, and then my last question, Hadley, is I know you have access to additional capital from Gotham Green, and am I correct in assuming, though, that you're not really able to pledge any more assets, so sale leasebacks beyond that are not really on the table? Is that correct?
No, I think anything's available. You know, one of the things we love working about with Gotham
is, we're a big equity play for them. It's structured as a senior secured piece of debt, but they're not in it for the lending returns. So anything that can effectively lower our cost of capital or allow us access to capital to build something out that enhances shareholder returns, they are in favor of. So there's nothing off the table from a corporate finance perspective.
Okay, so then I've seen some people, the reason I ask is I have seen some people that had sworn they wouldn't do sale leasebacks with certain New York Stock Exchange listed companies, do them anyway. So I'm just wondering, is that more of an option for you guys at this point in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, look, everything's an option. It's just a matter of what the cost is. A lot of these sale leasebacks are very costly because of the time commitment associated with them, right? You're locking in for a long period of time, and I think we all know within those time frames you're probably going to have full federal legality, and you're probably going to have wish that you had access to that Citibank mortgage at 3 points. So that's the trade-off you make. And on the other side, I can see why some of our peers would access that capital, because you can rationalize and think of it as cheap equity. If your choice is equity or a sale leaseback, I'd probably guess the sale leaseback is going to compare favorably to the cost of equity, given where stock prices are today. I can't fault people for making that decision. It's something that we have, it's one of the arrows we have in the quiver, and we look at that just like we look at any type of fundraising to continue to drive shareholder value.
All right. Well, it's good to hear you have that flexibility. Congratulations on the continued growth.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you. This concludes our question and answer session. Mr. Ford, I turn the call back over to you for closing remarks.
Fantastic. Thank you. And thank you all for dialing in for our third quarter earnings release. We wake up every day, our team does, ready to create iconic cannabis brands and great experiences for our customers. We wake up every day willing and able and go out and work very hard for you, our shareholders. And we thank you very much for your trust and support. We look forward to a good balance of this year and great opportunities in 2020. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.